You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Michael Stewart Foley is my guest. He's an historian and the author of several books, including one in that great 33 and a third series that I really love, on the Dead Kennedys album, Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables. And he's also written Confronting the War Machine, Draft Resistance During the Vietnam War, Front Porch Politics, the Forgotten Heyday of American Activism in the 70s and 80s. And his new book is Citizen Cash, The Political Life and Times of Johnny Cash. Michael Stewart Foley, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks, Gary. Thanks very much.
I really enjoyed this book, and it's a very interesting and complex book, because it's not really a biography, because you don't talk about a lot of the things that other biographers have talked about with Johnny Cash, but you specifically address the kind of hard to pin down political career of Johnny Cash. And you talk about the politics of empathy. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, the challenge when I started was thinking about the readership, you know, and how much of the familiar biography I had to include. So, you know, I tell a story that's chronological, but is focused primarily on his political evolution, you know. And I came to this politics of empathy idea because Cash, you know, all of his other biographers and anyone else who's ever written about him, and lots of people who knew him, said that he politically could be contradictory, you know, that he could hold positions that just didn't make sense, that he was a paradox, as more than one writer has called him. But I found that if that's really only true, if you think about politics through the typical labels that we use, you know, of liberal and conservative and left and right and Democrats and Republicans and things like that. And with Cash, really, he came to his politics not through any kind of ideological or partisan approach. He really came to politics on the basis of feeling, and mostly on the promptings of his own personal experience. And the way that he engaged with all of the political issues that I cover in the book is primarily through his own experience. And if he didn't really have personal experience with it, he was a pretty skilled researcher and a kind of obsessive researcher with a real commitment to social realism, you know? And so if he couldn't relate personally through something that he himself had experienced, he tried really hard to relate to people through that research. So his politics, and this politics of empathy, comes from this sense of relating to people in a way that goes beyond the way that we talk about ideology or party politics.
Well, I think one of the, you know, you talk a lot about the divided America of the 1960s, which feels very familiar to our current situation. And one of the things that keeps us divided today is this feeling that people's politics are united with what they believe rather than what they think. Yeah. And people are reluctant to change their minds, even in the face of evidence that proves them wrong. But looking at your life of Johnny Cash, and you quote from some of his letters that he wrote to his wife when he was in the service, you really see that he evolved. He changed a lot. I mean, his political views, but just his humanist views changed quite a bit during his lifetime.
Right. And, you know, I think that's true of most everybody, in fact, right? It's not the impression that we get from the political pundits and from, you know, the people who talk about these things on 24-hour news channels. But, you know, most of us, as we get older, as we experience more of the world, our views evolve, you know, and things, we're willing to accept a level of complexity that the, you know, experts would like us to think, you know, that maybe we don't. So, yeah, you know, in that case, you know, that was really an important example of Cash's political evolution and his empathy was that he wrote those letters back to Vivian, his first wife, you know, when she was still just his girlfriend from the Air Force in Germany, and used, you know, this horrible racist language because the guy had grown up in northeastern Arkansas, you know, in a segregated community surrounded by racists and had racist ideas himself. It's obvious, you know, from the letters. But he, you know, goes through a pretty dramatic transformation in the next 10 years for a variety of reasons, you know, that I spell out, and winds up really relating to the plight, especially of exploited Black working men, you know, because he could relate to hardworking people and he could relate through this kind of obsessive research that I was talking about. He really had this fixation on the Lomax recordings, you know, those Library of Congress recordings and field recordings that the Lomaxes did. And, you know, and then he ends up producing this album in 1962, Blood, Sweat, and Tears, that in the middle of the civil rights movement, that's all about, you know, the horrors visited on Black working men. And that was no accident. You know, you can't just do an album of songs about, you know, the ways that whites have terrorized Black men by accident in the middle of the civil rights movement. So that's a dramatic transformation in the space of 10 years.
So he could comment politically on a variety of things without stating his politics, merely by choice, the things that he chose to sing about or talk about or the guests he had on his shows or whatever.
Exactly. I think it's one of the advantages of the artist, you know, compared to some of the rest of us. They can speak through their art. They can speak through their associations with other artists and other artists' work, and Cash did a lot of that, you know. And one of the other ways that he evolved was that, you know, he became more confident as the 60s went on. And by the time he achieved superstardom and was a fixture in American households on a weekly television show, he was much more confident than he was in 1962 when he did Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And he could speak a little bit more plainly, you know, about some of the political issues that he was interested in.
I was struck also by the fact that as he aged, it's kind of a broad stroke, but it seems that as most people get older, they get more conservative. I mean, if you look at some other performers, like say Frank Sinatra or Van Morrison and Eric Clapton, now that they've kind of become old men, they're suddenly very conservative guys. But it seems like the older Johnny Cash got, he didn't live to be a very old man, but as he got older, he got more and more liberal.
Yeah. I mean, I try to avoid using those two terms, especially, yeah, you know, liberal and conservative in the book, but yeah, it would be hard to make a case, as I think a lot of people would like to, you know, that Cash, especially after he became this kind of national figure, almost like a statesman-like figure, that he had become more conservative, you know, and he played it pretty close to his vest. He didn't often indicate who he was campaigning for or hoping would win election, you know, in a presidential election. Although he did, you know, support Jimmy Carter in 76 and Al Gore in 88. But, you know, he appears on stage with Kris Kristofferson in New York and sings Masters of War when Kristofferson was singing that every night about the Contras, you know. So you can draw your own conclusions about how conservative he was based on, you know, signals like that.
Well, you've got a fabulous picture of him wrapped in the American flag on the front of your book. And yeah. I think you talk in your book about encountering some Republicans who claim him as their own. You know, he must be a Republican.
right.
And you talk about John Wayne and that kind of period where John Wayne was, you know, especially later in his life, was like an arch flag waving American.
Right.
But that was a, that was just some, that was two things that stood side by side with Cash, that he could love his flag and love his country, but not necessarily love everything that the country was doing.
Right. Which, you know, I think, again, I think is true of most of us, you know, and I've spent, you know, most of my career as a historian writing about people who get involved in grassroots politics and often not, you know, thinking of themselves as activists in the first place, but being moved in some way to get involved because a particular issue really affects them. And, you know, they would all define themselves as patriots, you know, for the most part. These are people who love America and who love a lot of things about America, but then they get involved in political movements and in activism because it's like they've got a little bit of a quarrel, you know, with their country, and they want their country to do better, and they want it to live up to the ideals that made them fall in love with it in the first place, you know. And I Cash certainly comes across that way, you know, if it's, particularly if you judge him by the way he engaged politics on his television show. You know, there's no question that he's a great patriot, and he's really committed to his love of the country, but practically every week he's got something to say about how it's falling short of its own ideals.
Right. Patriotism is not the exclusive emotion of Republicans, but rather shared by all Americans.
Right.
Yeah. Bob Dylan was one of the first guests on his television show. And I see a lot of parallels, strange parallels between the life of Cash and Dylan. And I don't know who influenced who, but both Cash and Dylan were interested in those field recordings that you mentioned and committed them to memory as part of their the body of knowledge they used as a performer and to write music. Both of them turned more religious at some point in their career. And Dylan was, you know, his fans were, it was a very divisive force in the Dylan fan base. And when Dylan recorded Slow Train Coming and Saved and swore off his older tunes for a year or two, people were very alienated. His fans were very alienated. And then there was a common belief that Johnny Cash alienated fans with his religious fervor as well, and traveling with Billy Graham. Do you see that? Did you think about those two together when you were writing?
I did. I mean, I Dylan and Cash kind of had this mutual admiration society between them, you know, and as you say, I think they both influenced one another. And it's true about, you know, Cash becoming more open about his faith, you know, when he had the television show, particularly in the second and then third season. The producers were really worried about it, and they claimed, you know, that the ratings were falling because he was being this open, and he was completely unmoved by their protests. But, you know, I think that period of his career is really fascinating because I think the association with Graham, you know, is legitimate because he spent a lot of time with Billy Graham and, you know, participated in a lot of his, you know, crusades, as they called them, these stadium size revival meetings, you know. But Cash also, you know, didn't follow Graham's party line either, you know, when it came to being a Christian. Like, if we associate that period with the rise of Christian conservatism and the Christian right, Cash doesn't have anything to say about any of those divisive issues. You know, his view as a Christian is that Christians aren't doing enough to look out for one another, and that his view is that they, as Christians, were put on this earth to witness to the poor, you know, and to look out for the downtrodden. And, you know, that's a consistent line through the 70s and 80s, this period that we associate with him being, you know, kind of like all the others, you know, a born again Christian, which he wasn't exactly. He was more like a reacquainted Christian, you know, because he'd grown up in the faith, but then he disappeared for a while with his drug addiction and only came back later in the late 60s.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking this week with Michael Stewart Foley. His latest book is called Citizen Cash, The Political Life and Times of Johnny Cash. Michael Stewart Foley, do you think that Johnny Cash's drug addiction helped him relate to younger people when recreational drug use became so popular?
I mean, he's, you know, when he engaged with young people, most famously on the television show, but not only on the television show, sometimes at the Billy Graham meetings too. That was one of the main things that he talked about, you know, was about finding, you know, understanding and relating to young people looking for meaning in their lives and, you know, mistakenly thinking like he did, that they could find it in drugs. Yeah, I think he really related to young people because he'd walked that crooked path, you know, and he felt like, you know, there were lots of young people who were kind of lost and doing the same thing. But then he also, you know, was prone to speaking to older Americans from the platform of his television show to tell them not to be too quick to judge these young people too, you know, that it's okay to search, you know, and it's okay to even to ramble and roam, you know, he says. So he plays an interesting role because he seems like he's a lot older than he was on the television show. You know, he's only like 38 or something when he gets it, but he looks like he's in his late 40s or something. And older people clearly related to him as well as younger people did.
Well, of course, he had a deep voice always, so that made him seem much more grown up, even when he was a young man. He was a few years older than Elvis, but not very much. I mean, he was of that same generation, obviously. And,
right.
And his voice alone is probably one of the most unique instruments in the history of popular music. I mean, there's no other voice like it. Even a voice like, say, Tex Ritter or some other kinds of singers that had that kind of register were more musical than he was. His voice was very odd. It's very odd that he would say, "I'll be a singer. I sing like this."
Yeah.
And I guess that way he's like Dylan as well, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Or Neil Young, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Cash was really encouraged by his family, especially his mother, you know, and who thought that he had, you know, this special gift. But you're right. It's not a typical gift.
You mentioned the guests that he had on his television program, and I'm a big fan of 70s variety shows. There were lots of them, and there was very few like that one. I guess the Smothers Brothers is the closest, in that the guests that he had were, I mean, even the Smothers Brothers still had, you know, George Gobel and Ethel Merman or whoever on their show, but they also had Donovan and the Beatles. And there were a lot of country music shows like Glenn Campbell's show, but Johnny Cash's show, specifically because of the guests he had, was very different.
Yeah.
Talk about some of those guests.
Well, I mean, he had, like you say, he had some of the great country music stars on, of course, you know, from George Jones and Merle Haggard and Tammy Wynette. All of those people made appearances. But he had, you know, these younger artists who, unless they had appeared on the Smothers Brothers show, you were never going to see on television, you know. So starting with, you know, Joni Mitchell and Dylan and Buffy St. Marie and the Guess Who, and speaking of Eric Clapton, Derek and the Dominoes and Creedence Clearwater Revival. And, you know, that was a pretty amazing array of younger artists who he was bringing to the Ryman Auditorium in Nashville, to where the show was filmed. This wasn't like Glenn Campbell out in Hollywood, you know, or in New York or something. So it was a real merger, of popular music, of rock and roll with country music in the mother church of country music, on television every week. Arlo Guthrie, these are not people who are appearing on television a lot. And then when he did the campus special, and he went to Vanderbilt and he had the Vanderbilt students come to the Ryman, then he had all kinds of young stars, up and coming young stars like James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt and Neil Young, so it was pretty incredible, to be able to tune in and see that each week.
Yeah. Amazing. He also, when we think of concept albums, we think of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band or Tommy, but years before at Columbia Records, Cash recorded all these amazing concept records.
Yeah.
And some of them are, I had really forgotten about them until you reminded me to pull them out and listen to them.
Right.
What are some of those records that you think are outstanding and people should listen to them again?
Well, I think, they're a little uneven, in their quality. And I think, it's like with the Prison albums, you can start an argument with any Cash fan about which one's the best one. But the Ride This Train album, is kind of the first coherent, really like well put together concept album, where he kind of narrates in between these songs and plays a range of songs from, all over the country and different parts of the country's history. The Blood, Sweat and Tears album I mentioned, which is, all about pretty much Black lives, and the Bitter Tears, Ballads of the American Indian. That's probably the one that's had the most enduring impact of the concept albums. And then, I think the Prison album, certainly Folsom, kind of counts as a concept album. I think that's kind of a culminating concept album for him. It's the one where he's most successful in playing the role of Alan Lomax himself, by capturing the sounds of the prisoners and the prison itself, along with all these songs that are taken from the American canon of prison songs.
You mentioned also in your book, I think it's in at the very end, you talk about the Johnny Cash at Madison Square Garden album that came out, I think, just toward the end of his life, or posthumously possibly. And
right.
And it's a great concert album. Talk a little bit about what appeals to you about that one.
Well, in fact, that's the album that got me started on this whole project nearly 20 years ago, in fact, because it came out in the end of 2002. And it was this, live recording that had never been released before from December, the first week of December, 1969. And so, I was a Cash fan. I went out and bought it because I thought, this is cool. I've never heard this before. And then at the time I was working on this book project about the Vietnam War. So I was immersed in the history of the Vietnam War. And 20 minutes into the concert, Johnny Cash starts talking to the Madison Square Garden audience about the Vietnam War, and not just for a moment or two, but in between several songs that he puts together, purposefully, to convey a message about both, his respect for the men who fight American wars, but also, the dream of peace, when he sings "Last Night I Had the Strangest Dream." So it's really fascinating. And I was stunned because I had never thought about Johnny Cash being a political artist at all. And here he is on this huge platform, on this huge stage, 20,000 people talking about the Vietnam War. And so that got me started, and that led to an article that I wrote finally, as a kind of side project some years later. And then because the article got some attention, I ended up thinking about, well, maybe I ought to write a book about him.
Was Cash the master of his own output? Did he decide what songs that he would perform in concert? Did he decide what songs would go on albums?
I think in concert, he was pretty much the master of his set list. I think, but on albums, There was, depending on the stage of the of his career that we're talking about, there was a lot of negotiating with the producers. Sam Phillips exercised tremendous creative control at the beginning at Sun Records. At Columbia, Cash had much more of a say of, how these albums would be put together. And sometimes the record company didn't like it so much, but they let him do it because he was their star. And then in the 70s, he does a lot of albums that are not super well regarded. And part of that's because at the time he was so overexposed, he wasn't really writing many of his own songs. And he was kind of cycling through producers who were trying this style or that style. And so that's when he probably had the least creative control. And, it shows in the records. There's some great music on those records, but there's also a lot of, underwhelming material.
Yeah. One of my favorite later albums of his at Columbia is Johnny 99. I think that's the name of the album. That's a really fine album where he does a couple of Springsteen tunes, but also the whole feeling of that record was a really good one.
Yeah, I think that's one of the times where he finally got what he wanted, out of his producers. Because he talked for years about trying to get back to that Sun Record sound. And the way he does Johnny 99 and Highway Patrolman, that's getting pretty close to it.
Did he have a falling out with Sam Phillips? Why did he leave Sun and go to Columbia, do you know?
Well, he left because Columbia offered him a lot of money and more creative control. Don Law caught up with him and basically said, we'll let you do whatever you want. And Cash's telling, it was about Sam Phillips' refusal to let him do a gospel album. Like Cash had from the very beginning wanted to do an LP of gospel tunes. And Sam Phillips said, I can't sell those kind of records. I love that music too, but I can't sell them. And Columbia said, you can do as many gospel records as you want. And he did two, in fact, pretty quickly after he signed over to them.
Yeah,
but they did end
Columbia
up kind
record.
Of having, sorry?
His second Columbia record is a gospel
exactly.
record.
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. And then he, as a result though, he did kind of have a falling out with Phillips because, he was having these conversations kind of without Phillips's knowledge, and Phillips didn't like that. And they later reconciled.
I'm sure Sam Phillips already knew what it felt like to have a great artist leave him and go to a big.
I believe he did. Yeah.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we are talking tonight with author Michael Stewart Foley. His latest book is called Citizen Cash, The Political Life and Times of Johnny Cash.
I was surprised to learn that Johnny Cash wrote a novel, and you say it's one of the greatest works of his life.
I do say so. I recommend that people read it because I was pretty astonished at the level of skill and knowledge. It's no easy thing to write a novel. This is The Man in White, which is mostly the story of the Apostle Paul, who Cash had this long time fascination with, and at first had toyed with the idea of just, writing a biography of Paul, but then instead decided to write the novel. And, he's not, this is not like, Nobel Prize quality literature, but it's a very good read. It's a plausible plot, the way he lays it out. He stays pretty close to what we do know, in fact, about the life of St. Paul. And it's important in his larger work too, because of the message, of in talking about the transformation of Saul into Paul from persecutor into apostle. It's totally consistent with this other message that he was putting across all the time about his faith and about the need to witness and to look out for the downtrodden. So, I think, I don't know how many Johnny Cash fans, have read that book. I don't think it, despite the efforts of the estate, even after Cash's death, to put it out, in a new paperback edition and stuff like that. I don't know. I know a lot of Johnny Cash fans. I don't know many of them who've read the book, but
I didn't even really think I knew about it until when you mentioned the title in the book, The Man in White. And I said, oh yeah, because he wrote The Man in Black and then he wrote The Man in White, but I didn't read it, pay any attention.
Right. Yeah. It's a pretty good read.
Well, it's interesting because I think it kind of relates to his acting career. I happen to be a fan of his acting career, and most people don't even consider that he had an acting career, but he really did. And not only was he the most sympathetic murderer in the history of Columbo, but there were a couple of TV films that he made, and you mentioned them, and one of them, The Murderer in Coweta County. I think that's a really fine film, and I think he's excellent in it.
Right, I do too. I think he's really good in it, and I also like The Pride of Jesse Hallam, about this illiterate, you know, farmer who moves to the city because his daughter is ill, and then just has a hard time getting a job because he can't read, you know, any documents. And you know, Cash said that he took the role because he knew people like that. You know, he could relate to people like that, that he'd grown up around people like that, and he wanted to, you know, destigmatize it and make it clear that, you know, people can overcome this, and they can overcome the stigma. So that's pretty consistent too with the messaging. Like, I think he's very, in an earlier draft of the book, I actually wrote quite a bit about the television shows because I thought it was really interesting. But some of it, a lot of it wound up on the cutting room floor.
Oh, I want to read those parts. So it's interesting that he could, the same kind of decision-making that went into, you know, having Odetta on his variety show would say, oh, I'm going to play this part in this film.
Yeah, exactly. I think he only, you know, he only took roles that spoke to him in some way, you know, and that he could clearly relate to the character and relate to the plot. You know, I think it's significant. He plays John Brown in the North and South miniseries, right? And that's really, you know, I don't know if he went out of his way to get that role, because it's hard to find details about how he was cast, but you know, that's a big turnabout from who he was as a young man, you know.
And if people know Andy Griffith from the Andy Griffith Show or Matlock, they would be, I think fans of Face in the Crowd would find Murder in Coweta County worth their time, because Andy Griffith turns in a really great performance in that movie about, you know, what it's like to be a racist. I mean, he is just.
Yeah. Yeah, he's really villainous. Like, you know, this is not Mayberry.
No.
This guy's a real mean jerk.
Some of Johnny Cash's television specials that he did later after his run on ABC were also remarkable. And I wish I could find them. And I read in your book that you went to the Museum of Radio and Television, or the Paley Center,
right,
to see some of that stuff. And there was one that he did later on where he used Turn Your Radio On as the sort of the theme of the show. And I only saw it when it was on. I haven't seen it since, but I have strong memories of that wonderful
schedule. Yeah. Some of them are pretty good. Some of them are a little bit, you know, cornball too. Like, you know, in the way that those other variety shows tended to be a little cornball. Some of his specials also, there's one special with Tony Orlando in it. Most of it was shot at Cash's farm in Tennessee, and it's pretty tough to swallow because some of the humor is so bad, you know. But then other times, as you say, that some of it's great, you know. I wish the television show, his television show especially, was available as a box set or something, because it's just such a fascinating artifact, you know. But then some of the specials too would be great to have. And I felt privileged to go to the libraries and be able to, you know, watch these things. Sometimes they had to convert them to digital for me because the tapes, you know, weren't getting too old.
The two DVD set that they put out of the Best of Johnny Cash Show, I want to ask you about that, because it seems to me that it's curated in a way that is, well, I don't know. I won't say. What do you think of that two disc set?
Well, I think it's fantastic. in the way, in the range of performances that are chosen and presented. I think it's really wonderful. But yes, I am critical of the way that it's presented in the narration, and in the way that, you know, this was put out after his death, you know, and so it's the estate that's, you know, kind of framing Johnny Cash as a guy who brings everybody together, you know, that he's completely non-controversial and apolitical, you know. And I joke in the book that it's like we're talking about him like he's a light beer, you know, that tastes great and is less filling, you know, that he's nothing offensive about him. And, you know, as my research shows, that's just not true. You know, he was a deeply, deeply engaged political artist. He, one of the things that's most fascinating about him and admirable about him is that as a public citizen, he was prepared to kind of work out his own thinking about political issues on this stage, on television every week, you know, and to evolve right in front of viewers' eyes. And that's a real gift, you know, to fellow citizens. And we shouldn't diminish that, you know, by saying he, you know, he was just this great guy who transcended everything and, you know, didn't offend anyone.
Because he actually dug in on a lot of his issues.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I joked with my editor at one point when we were working on revising one of the drafts, and I said, you know, this is going to sound ridiculous, but if I've done my job right, you know, everyone who's a Johnny Cash fan who thinks that they're a Republican and so is he, or thinks that they're a Democrat and so is he, should be annoyed by this book, you know, because he says things on all these issues that could annoy, you know, either side. And if you're an ideologue and you think only in ideological terms, Cash is going to be kind of a vexing figure for you. But I think, like I say, he's, as a public citizen, it's in a time of really polarized politics, which, you know, the 1960s was, as one historian has said, was like practically a civil war. It's a model, you know, worth emulating.
We also should talk about Johnny Cash's last act, which was such a phenomenal recording period with Rick Rubin and those pared down recordings and the songs that he chose to perform of Nine Inch Nails or U2 or just some amazing, those are just what an amazing quality recordings he made there at the end.
I love those recordings. I love the unearthed box set, you know, that came out with all the stuff that didn't even make it onto those records that they put out after he died. I think the whole project is genius, you know. And I think, you know, it served a particular purpose, and was also curated, you know, in a particular way by Rick Rubin. Because in Rubin's memory, Johnny Cash had become this kind of overexposed Christian family guy who showed up to do these Christmas specials once in a while. And he wanted to introduce a younger audience to the outlaw Johnny Cash, you know, the darker Johnny Cash. And those records really do that really well. But they also, you know, speaking of his voice, capture that voice at the end of his life where it's changed, but it's also so distinctive. It could be no one else. There's very few songs on there that, on those records that I don't love, you know.
And I was thinking of it when I was listening to Rough and Rowdy Ways, the most recent Bob Dylan record, where his voice has descended to some new level of cragginess.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Also distinctive in its own way, but
yeah. Yeah. You talked to both Roseanne Cash and John Cash, Johnny Cash's offspring.
I never talked to John Carter Cash. we never connected. I tried to connect with him once when I was in Nashville, and it didn't work out. I did correspond with Roseanne, and we've done an event since when, just even before the book came out, at the last Johnny Cash Heritage Festival together. That was really great. But she's very wary, of talking about her father's politics, because she doesn't want to slip into accidentally, speaking for him when he's not here to speak for himself,
Well, that makes sense. But
Makes sense.
does she like your book?
I don't know. I think so. She, she did that event with me, and she said she was really happy I had done it. But yeah, I don't know. I hope she likes it. I think she, I don't, the other children are not as prominent as public figures, and so I don't know as much about them or what they are likely to think of the book. But she's a prominent kind of public citizen herself. She's active on social media, and she speaks her mind about political issues that she's interested in. So yeah, I'd like to think she likes it, but in fact, I don't know. Her manager told me he's a fan. So, that's one degree of separation.
Oh, in researching Michael Stewart Foley, I found that you had been a technical advisor on Mad Men, which I think is one of the greatest things ever. I don't know. I mean, it's a television series, but it's kind of a 75-hour movie.
Right.
And I wonder what your involvement was and what did you do for Mad Men?
Well, I worked, not really worked, because they didn't pay me or anything, but I advised them as a historian. And it started in season six, when the chronology of the show gets to the Vietnam War, and they had a plot line that they were working on. They were very cryptic about it when they approached me about who they were and what they were doing. But then so I ended up advising them first on that plot line, and then on other kind of questions about how to engage the politics of the late 60s on the show in the last two seasons. So
And
yeah,
did
it
you
was.
see what your advice reflected in the final product?
I did, yeah, and in fact, it was a weird process because it was so secretive. I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. I couldn't tell anybody that I was, assisting in any way until after the episodes aired. After they first streamed or something, then we could, I could talk about it, and I never saw any of the episodes in advance. So only after they came out did I see them. And so there was a long gap between the time when I was, staying up all night. This is when I lived in England, and I was frantically writing emails about how this idea they had was completely implausible and would never happen, and you should try, something else. And, to their credit, and really to, like, I quite admired it, the way that they could integrate advice on a historical subject into dialogue, the creative process of just coming up with dialogue that suited the political issue in a way that made complete sense and was totally plausible, I thought was really interesting. And unfortunately, I don't actually know how they did that, because I didn't get to see that part of the process. I just gave the advice and didn't hear anything back, and then saw it on the show. But I was happy with it because, so I've been historical advisor on other films and other kinds of projects, and people, directors, they don't always take your advice. So I felt like on Mad Men they did,
Well, that's fascinating. And also fascinating and great is this book, Citizen Cash: The Political Life
Thank
and
you.
Times of Johnny Cash, by my guest, the brilliant Michael Stewart Foley. Thank you so much for being with us on From the Bookshop.
Thank you, Gary. I really appreciate it.
that's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.